And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Harry P. from Santee.
My name is Harry and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to congratulate the people who had their cakes and tokens. I'm so impressed today with how fast people get time. You know, I always have a difficult time anymore making sure that I qualify for this program. I often feel like saying I got up one Sunday morning and decided, oh, what a beautiful day, I think I'll go to AA. Obviously, it wasn't that way. I took my first drink when I was 13. I got drunk, and I got drunk most days thereafter until I came in this program at age 31. And a lot of things happened in between. Shortly after I took my first drink, I had my first arrest. And I went through that was age 13. And I had a few encounters with the juvenile system. I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio. And I got a chance to see the insides of the Franklin County Jail in a few places. As a matter of fact, at the Franklin County Jail is one of the places I decided that, well, maybe my father helped me a little bit. My father told me that if I was old enough to get put in jail, I was old enough to get out by myself. And I stayed in there once for 17 days. I was in a car with six or seven other guys, and there was some little misunderstanding about the ownership of the vehicle. Well, the guy that owned it was in New Guinea. And so we had a nice little army recruiter that came around, and all the rest of the guys were 18 or older, and he was recruiting, and they weren't having anything to do with it, but I knew I was a man, so I thought it was a great idea. To make a long story short, as a teenager, I wound up in the United States Army. And I think today, after looking at some of those pictures, I may have looked a little younger than I thought I did at the time. And that's probably why the field first sergeant and the first sergeant used to take me to town, and they would buy me a few drinks, and then they'd laugh the next day about this little, well, I won't use the term they used, how we took him to town last night and he got drunk and everything. I never asked the question of who got me drunk before I got there. But that was the beginning of a Army career. I stayed in the Army for 9 years, 9 months, and 9 days. And a few Purple Hearts later, I came out of the Army. Came out of the Army in 1954. And I had a total disability. I have a few Purple Hearts, like I said, and I have what they, in those days, they call it chronic nervous anxieties. And I went to VA, and VA was giving me a lot of pills. When I came to the program, I remember my sponsor going by my house and looking in this cabinet, and they saw all these jars of phenobarbital that VA was giving me. And my son took one of the many pills that they were giving me and almost died from it. And I went to my family doctor, and I had about 14 different meds. VA never canceled a prescription. They just gave you a new one in those days. And this doctor would tell me what was in the drugs. He said, there's codeine in this one, and drop it in the wastebasket. And he said, there's codeine in this one, and drop it in the wastebasket. And he left me with about four different bottles there and told me that I had to get used to the fact that I was going to have pain for the rest of my life, and I should get used to it and get rid of those things too. But my son took these pills, and I got a little upset over it. And I was afraid. I thought the only thing to do was what the Army had taught me to do. And this woman, I should tell you, at VA, I had a psychiatrist, a clinical psychologist, and a psychologist at the time. And this psychiatrist, she's the one that was giving me all these pills. And she's the one that wouldn't tell Children's Hospital what the drugs were. But I had a friend of mine in VA, and he was able to convince her to give him the information, and also for her to start thinking a little different about some of the drugs she was giving me. So I went in to her, and she decided, since I had this nervous condition and that she was giving me these sedatives for this condition, she instead decided she would give me a prescription that I could take to the liquor store, and I get 2 bottles of whiskey a week for my nerves. Now, my brother ran a bar at the time, and I stopped by my brother's bar before I did anything. And I stopped by and I showed him this prescription, and he said, "Do you mean you can get anything?" I said, "Well, that's what they told me." So we had state liquor stores, state liquor control in Ohio. So I went down to the liquor store, and he told me to go down there and ask for 2 bottles of 25-year-old Ambassador Scotch. So I went down there, and I took the slip, I filled it out, gave the prescription to the cashier. He stamped the things, and the other guy gave me 2 bottles of 25-year-old Ambassador Scotch for my nerves. This may come as a shocking surprise to some of you, but it didn't help me a whole lot. And this guy at VA, Sam went in and told her that it wasn't doing too good, and he thought it was a good idea if she restricted it to 86 proof. That didn't do exactly the right thing either, you know. I went through a lot of things with VA. But, you know, I had some serious drinking buddies. And one of my serious drinking buddies came into this program. And by this time, I'd wavered my half of my disability, and I'd went to work at the United States Post Office. And my serious drinking buddy worked at the post office, and these guys would get off in the middle of the night, and about 20 of them would go down to my brother's bar that should have closed at 2:30. Well, he did lock the door at 2:30, and it reopened at 5, and we were still there. And my serious drinking buddy, all at once we start missing him. And then one evening, the day of our annual credit union banquet, I asked him if he was going to my brother's bar, and he said no. I just never liked that no. I wonder if he was mad at me or something. And then I asked him about it, and he said, "Harry," said, "I don't want to drink tonight," said. "I've joined AA, and I'm not drinking." He said, "I go to meetings." Meetings. That didn't impress me at all. Thomas going to meetings. And he said, "Sit down, I'll tell you about it." So he started trying to tell me about these things, and I said, "What do you do for friends, Tom?" "Well, I know where our friends were, my brother's bar." And he said, "Harry, you wouldn't believe it, but I've got more friends than I ever had in my life," which I didn't believe. I said, "What do you do with your time, knowing how many hours that we spent in my brother's bar?" He said, "I said, you wouldn't believe it, but I have hardly any time anymore." I didn't believe that either. But I told Tom, I said, "Well, Tom, I think it's good for you. As for my drinking, it doesn't hurt anybody but me. And besides, I could stop anytime I wanted to. That was February 1962. And for the next 4.5 months, I did everything I could to prove to Tom that I could quit drinking anytime I wanted to. Then I began to doubt whether I wanted to. And finally came one night in June. I got off from work, and I got off from work with another serious drinking buddy who later came in this program and spent the rest of his life in it. But I ran into this guy, and I realized I was showing pictures of my kids, the people in the bar, but I only saw my kids on the weekend. And on the weekend, they had to be quiet, because if they didn't, Daddy would get upset and he would leave. And she was right, because Daddy always got upset on Saturday and always left. Well, anyway, this one night I called home from my brother's bar, and I told my wife that I wanted to call Tom and ask Tom to come over. I wanted to talk to him. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Tom. Tom had a raggedy car with fenders hanging on it. I used to take Tom to his front door, lean him up against the front door, knock on the front door, and before his wife answered, run like hell. She would throw things and say, you took my Tom out and got him drunk again. But anyway, Tom told her to have me call. I called Tom, I told Tom I wanted to talk to him. And see, this is a guy who used to live next door to me, and I used to have a friend that, remember, I'm from Ohio, and he was from southern Ohio, and he was from the New Straitsville, Ohio. Now, maybe a lot of you are too young to know the significance of New Straitsville, but back during the days of Prohibition, that's where you got the brown whiskey from, you know. And this guy used to bring me back these jugs of moonshine. And Tom used to come over, and we all would enjoy that moonshine. And now Tom wants to know what I want to talk to him about. So he said, Harry, if you want to talk about your drinking, I'll come over. If you don't, it's late, and it sounds like we both should go to bed. So I gave in. Tom came over, but instead of coming by himself, Tom brought some stranger with him. And every time I tried to talk to my friend Tom, this stranger would talk to me. And finally, this stranger, he kept talking about himself. He stopped telling me about all the stupid things he got into. He started telling me about his time in the Army and in Korea. And he started telling me how he got thrown out of the Army. And all at once, I start relating to him. All at once, I was listening to him, because I just felt like he understood. Now, I didn't know what he understood, but I just felt like he understood. Well, these guys talked me into going to an AA meeting the next morning, which was Sunday morning. I don't know if you guys ever been bewildered, but somebody tell you they're going to take you to downtown Columbus, Ohio, to one of the best restaurants in town, to an AA meeting. In broad daylight. I mean, what do you wear when you go downtown to, he said there are alcoholics there, right? You know, people that sleep under the bridge, that wear their army overcoats. And we're going down to Kenning's Restaurant. Wow. And I remember crossing the Broad High that morning. I realized that fear started coming into me. And we went to a restaurant, and they said that it's behind those velvet tapestries at the back of the restaurant. And as I went through those tapestries, this fear really came over me. Because they had talked about these meetings. And I remember Steve had said, I get my medicine at these meetings. And Tom had said, I get the full charge of the program when I go to these meetings. Now, when I go through this velvet tapestry now, am I going to get this medicine in a souffle cup or a hypo or what? And VA had gave me some charges. So I didn't know what they were going to do with those charges there. Of course, when I went through that velvet tapestry, I did get a shock. Because I saw you people for the first time. And you were not what... It was shocking that you were not what I thought you were. The men, and I know this dates my sobriety, the men was wearing white shirts and ties. The women were all well dressed. And I was shocked. But fortunately, there was a couple of guys came up to me. And I recognized one guy from the newspaper. He had had a slip. And they had a picture of him sitting on the floor in this bar. He had broken this bar. And when the cops got there, he was just sitting there by the bar with an empty bottle beside him, you know. And the other guy was a little Gandhi dancer, always shaking the coins in his pocket. And for some reason, I could relate to those guys. John, the other guy, he had been a prize fighter, and his face was a little twisted and everything, but they're the only two in the room that looked like they might be alcoholics, you know? And I had all these people come up to me, and they kept shaking my hand and said, keep coming back, we're glad to see you, we need you. And I thought, now who are they trying to con, you know? And that was my first introduction to AA. The speaker that morning was a lady from Zanesville, Ohio. Her name was Ruth T. And Ruth was one of the early women to come around this program. And Ruth had had a hard time making this program. She would go to Akron or Cleveland and she would get sober. She would come back to Zanesville, and there was nobody there, no AA, women AAs there or anything, and she would slowly slip. And finally, she told about a lady named Polly. If you guys are old-timers, you would know these people. But Polly had a restaurant in Zanesville, Ohio, and she started working with Polly. Well, she told her story. It was really a story of hopelessness. All those failures. Now, I must confess that she had positive things in her talk, too. But I couldn't relate to those, but I could relate to all the negative things that happened to her. So I always said, from Ruth's talk, out of her hopelessness, I got hope. I got hope. I sat at a table that morning, and this is so difficult for me today, but I sat at a table that morning, and the guy who took me to the meeting, or the two guys took the meeting, Tom and Steve, and another guy who was my age, who had drank in the same bars that I did, named Al, they were to the left of me, and then there was three real old guys sitting to the right. And they all had 13 years of sobriety. And I couldn't relate with them at all. But Al had 1 month and 22 days without a drink. And I saw Al drink. I knew how he drank. And can you imagine that? 1 month and 22 days without a drink. I was impressed. I wasn't impressed with those 13 years. One of the things about getting a little time in this program is that of those guys that were there at that table, there's only one alive today. One of the guys that had 13 years, we called him Mr. Chris, and Mr. Chris died last week in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and he was somebody normally, my wife and I, we normally attend, we're back in Ohio in the summer, and we normally go to his anniversary every year. But Mr. Chris had came in 1949 in the program on there. And the other guy, Steve, is still alive, but Steve's got a little bit of Alzheimer. So I'm the only one that's still pretty active in the program. But these guys are all very active themselves. Steve was very active in 12-step work. Steve never got sleep at night. I worked at the post office. I worked at a substation. I was supposed to be there at 6:30 in the morning. And every night between midnight and 3 o'clock, Steve would call me to go on some 12-step call. I don't know why drunks can't get sober at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then Bob and Charlie, they were addicted to meetings. They were addicted to meetings. They went to, oh my God. I went to over 400 meetings that first year in the program. Now, I had four kids. And I would try to tell them that, you know, I have four kids. And they would tell me, yeah, yeah, we understand. We'll pick you up at 7:30. And then you had the guys that was all involved in service. Now, the group that I grew up in that Friday I went to was called the Poindexter Group in Columbus, Ohio. And it's a very well-known group back there. And one of the reasons why it's well-known is because the group has always been highly dedicated to service. So when I was sober about 5 months, well, you know, I always say I start getting volunteered at 5 months. And maybe that's because I'm not counting those volunteer things as washing dishes, as a greeter, cleaning ashtrays, you know. But I got volunteered for the first time for Joan's service that September. You know how you get volunteered. We used to have our group conscience in the kitchen after the meeting. And, you know, the old timers, Bob and Charlie, they would say, we got to have a new general service here coming up next Sunday. And Tom, you're the GSR. And Harry, you're the alternate. Be there at 2:30, you know. And I didn't know you had an option on it. I didn't even know that an alternate, only one had to show up. You know, they never told me that. You know, whenever I go back to Columbus and go to that meeting or any meeting in Columbus, a lot of people always talk about the Poindexter Group because they say we have reserved seats on all the committees. We don't have reserved seats. We had co-founders who believed very much in service, and they got all of us involved. If you would go to that group on any Friday night, when you walk through the front door, there's going to be about 7 or 8 people on either side, and by the time you run that gauntlet, if you're a new person, you may have a sponsor and a job. You know. They believe in service. You know, now, I'm not saying that I was 100% gung-ho to stop drinking. Truth of the matter is, I didn't think it was possible. I had no more concept of not drinking than I would of not eating or going to the toilet or anything like that. But I did want some of these negative things to stop happening to me. You know, I wanted some of the things to stop happening to me on the job. I'd had the assistant postmaster come out to the station where I was working and told me that he knew my date of hire and my estimated date of fire. Yeah. And then my wife was having some problems. And not just, one of the problems she had was buying bad brooms. You know, I'd come home sometime and rather than go right in the house, I would lay down on the porch to rest a few minutes. And I'd wake up and there'd be these broom straws all over the porch. Or sometime I'd go upstairs and wake up in the morning and there would be bacon and eggs on my pillow. Or the pizza set out in the fence. You know, I heard a guy give a talk one night, and he was talking about his wife beating him with a belt. And I got up to make a comment like we do back there, and she started tugging at my coat and told me to sit down. And boy, if I had woke up with her hitting me with that belt, and even with the buckle, wow. Good thing I worked hard and I was tired. You know, I told you those guys was addicted to meetings. I was sober almost 5 years before I went to a meeting in Franklin County, the county that Columbus is in. On Saturday nights, we went to Portsmouth. We went to Cleveland. We went to Newark. We would go to breakfast meetings hundreds of miles away. They really had a problem. They were really addicted to these things. And you know, by getting involved in general service, and they also got me addicted to conventions and roundups and things. They would tell me, said Harry, said those things are the icing on the cake, you know. And I was sober now of only a few months. And they told me I had to start saving my money because in 1965 they were going to have an international convention in Toronto, Canada. Now, they just got through telling me that I was supposed to live one day at a time, right? I mean, they're telling me that I got to put my mind and my body in the same time frame at the same time. And now they're telling me what we're going to do 3 years from now, you know. And they start taking me to all these things, you know. Now, my home group, I learned a lot from these guys. Oh, my God, I can't tell you how much I learned from these guys. For instance, when we're going out of town to those things, like the first one I went to was a state convention in Toledo, Ohio. And what they would do, they would tell me, said, get a suite of rooms up there at the Commodore Perry Hotel. I said, why? It's just my wife and I. He said, do what we tell you. Get a suite of rooms. I get a suite of rooms. And then if somebody is new there and doesn't have any money or anything, they would go up to him and said, Felix, said, Harry's going to have the hospitality room. He's going to need help. Said, why don't you ride up with Tom and you can stay there in one of those rooms, you know. I remember one guy told me he went up there with $1.37 in his pocket and came back with $10 and something he won playing poker. But you know, they do that to this day. If we go to Founders Day or to the International or something, you'll always find over 100 members of our group that'll be there. We still do what the old timers told us to do. I got in the habit of carrying a coffee pot and some goodies with me to these things. So I would run into the old timers and things. A lot of you know Chuck and some of the old timers, and I would invite them up to the room during the period at the convention where they had the little downtime and everything. And I got a chance to meet a lot of these old-timers and pioneers and things. And when I use that term, let me share with you what I mean. I consider Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and Jim Burwell and all those guys like that, I consider them the pioneers of the program, Bill Dotson. And then there's the old-timers. And then a lot of my friends that I associate with, they say we're third generation AAs. So I got used to these things, and then when we went to Toronto in 65, I was the chairman of the hospitality room for the Hall Convention. And we were fortunate enough to get the only room on the mezzanine floor at the Royal York Hotel. And it was a room about the size of this one with a couple of doors up there. I went there and I talked to the catering manager about the coffee. They had given me the coffee in those days was $4.70 a gallon. I think it's about $65 a gallon now. But anyway, they had given me $235 to buy coffee for the hospitality room. And I talked to the catering manager, and he told me he would give me this room and that he would dry run it. If I'd come there on Wednesday morning at 7 o'clock, he would dry run it. He'd put coffee in, and the room would be set up and everything. So I got there at 7 o'clock. He was there. Everything was beautiful. He left, and there was a knock on the door, and I opened the door, and there was Bill Wilson and a bunch of those old pioneers there. And this is the day before it starts now. And they said, well, we heard you got coffee. Well, it took about 10 minutes, and that room was packed. And I started buying coffee, and by 11 o'clock, my $235 was gone. A lady from Newark, Ohio, she had brought some cookies, and she had them in one of those big punch bowl, crystal bowls there. And she had these cookies there, and by 11 o'clock, the cookies were gone. And her husband, Ed took and tore the back off of a legal pad and wrote on there donations for coffee and put it in front of this. And so people start throwing money in there and everything. And instead of keeping it over the few short hours they told me, I kept it open as long as there was anybody there to do it. I went back to Columbus. I had almost $300 left. But I learned a lot in that room. You know, sometime in the program, we don't always realize what we're going through. Sometimes we have to look back on things to realize where we've been, what different things happen. And our delegate came around, and I complained to him because the other people on the committee wasn't showing up for their assignments. And he was a nuclear engineer from Parkersburg, and he had one of these Meerschaum pipes. And he patiently listened to me as I complained about these things. And he told me, he said, "Horse shit, Harry." He said, "You're getting just what you came here for, fellowship." And you know, I got a chance to meet Bill Wilson and all these other old-timers and everything that I wouldn't have met if I hadn't been involved in the service. I went all the way through the chairs of our central office. I went through the chairs of general service, everything except delegate. By the time I reached that point, AA was interfering with my life in many ways. And you know, you volunteer for these jobs in AA. And even though I'd been in the Army and had some little bit of authority in the Army, it's one thing when you are trying to manage with a big stick, when people look up to you and know that all the authority of the United States Army is behind you. When you're working with volunteers in AA, you have to use leadership. These people don't have to do nothing. You've got to encourage them. You've got to motivate them. You've got to make sure they have the things there that you need. And so I learned a lot from that. And as a matter of fact, some of the people in the post office, remember these people were going to fire me? They start promoting me. And I got promoted to foreman. Matter of fact, I got promoted to general foreman and assistant superintendent and superintendent. And can you imagine an alcoholic like me becoming postmaster? The miracles of this program. The miracles of this program. But I had so many things that's happened to my life since then that I can trace to the things that you people have walked me through and taught me in this program. I see a lot of people who tell me they're not getting it. And maybe they're not getting it because they're not giving it. I encourage everybody, get involved. I don't care whether you're going to be a greeter or you're going to wash dishes or you're going to go and work through the steps of general service or or the central office or what, but get involved. I've been fortunate enough to meet so many wonderful people in this program. I told you I met Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck Chamberlain and the guy who was charge of central office in those days, they gave me a chance to be a speaker at the International in Miami in 1970. And if you remember, that was the last one that Bill attended. As a matter of fact, he had a brunch for the speakers that morning, and then he was supposed to speak at 1 o'clock that afternoon. And we were all in the convention center at 1 o'clock, and nothing happened. Nobody came out on the stage, and about 1:30, finally somebody came out and said Bill had taken sick, but he was still going to come. And then finally they told us he was going to come, and the ambulance was bringing him over, and he was going to speak to us from a wheelchair. And he did, but he didn't speak from a wheelchair. He pulled that wheelchair up and pulled himself up on that podium and gave a great talk. And a lot of you know that was his final talk there because he died about 5 months later on there. But I wouldn't have met all these people without being in service. I've had a chance to speak a few times. I had the chance to speak there. I had a chance to speak at 2000 at the International. And most of all, I got a chance to speak at Founders Day in Akron, which I have been to Founders Day 44 of the last 46 years. And I always say that going there every year, I don't care how much time you've got, it raises your level of sobriety. And I have so many friends and things there. A lot of the old timers adopted me when I first came in. You know, there was the guy who was the third black guy that came in AA. His name was Ed, and his wife's name was Cora. And Founders Day in those days was only a Sunday morning breakfast. And Cora would start cooking about a week before. And everybody at that breakfast, Bill and everybody else, would go out to their house, and they would be there till Monday morning on there. And I was setting out, I have certain little times in this program that are little monuments along the way to me. Because I told you, I was staying in here, and I was aware that some of those negatives weren't happening to me anymore. But I was a little short on seeing the positives that was happening to me. And we had went there after this Founders Day, and we were sitting outside of Ed's house, and we had listened to these old-timers tell these stories about sleeping in doorways, sleeping in trash bins, and this and that. And Ed lived on a corner. And Ed had backed his Fleetwood Cadillac, a beautiful black Fleetwood Cadillac, and he had backed it out of the garage, and they had a table in there with snacks and everything. And I was sitting out there with Al and a couple of guys, and I said, boy, oh boy, look at that Cadillac. And Al said, yeah, but I like Tommy's Cadillac. And the other guy said, well, what about Charlie Dern's Cadillac? And then I noticed that up and down the street here was all these Cadillacs. If you want what we have, it changes things. And you know, the spiritual part of this program, now, Before I came to this program, I told you I spent a lot of time at my brother's bar, but I was also a very good practicing Catholic. My kids were altar boys. I was did my little things there too on Sunday morning. And I always made the 5 o'clock mass on the way home. But you know, I heard Bill Wilson talk about what happened to him in Towns Hospital, the flash of light and everything. I read about this in the book. But you know, in 1963, I took my kids up to Cadillac Mountain in Maine to see a full eclipse. And I went to some meetings at Hull's Cove and everything, and one Friday night they told me that Bill was going to come up the next day. And I didn't know it was Bill Wilson at the time, to tell you the truth, because there's a guy named Bill that took AA to all those places up along the St. Lawrence River. But he told me they were going to have a barbecue at 1 o'clock, and I went over there. We went down to the railroad station. Now, that consisted of the train coming up, and they threw a step down. But out came Bill W. on there. And that night, we were down in this guy's basement. And Bill talked about that flash of light and that incident. And all at once, it was different to me. All at once, it was different. And I realized a lot of us didn't really understand some of the things that had happened to him. And for some reason, I think I really got the spiritual part of the program that night. And I got a lot of surprises, too. I found out that after that flash of light, he didn't stay sober. I always thought when that happened that he stayed sober. Well, he didn't. As a matter of fact, while he was alive, I used to go to his birthday party in New York every year, and it seemed like he was constantly changing his sobriety date. Well, I think back then they didn't know how important that was going to be, you know. But all these experiences I could tell you about a lot of them. A lot of good things happened to you in 46 years in this program. You meet a lot of wonderful people. My wife and I, we lived full-time in our motorhome for 20-some years, going all over the country and making a lot of meetings, making a lot of roundups. And it's nice that everywhere you go anymore, you can find somebody you know. I've been over in Europe, and I could tell you lots about the AA over there and some of our experiences there. And what I was told when I first came in that I really can't agree with is when they told me that I get out of this program what I put in it. But I can tell you now that I can never get out of this, never put enough in this program for what I've gotten out of it. I live a comfortable life. I got a comfortable wife. I have a nice place to live. You know, when I came in, there was those who didn't think that I could make it because, well, they didn't think you could make it then. If you came in with a wristwatch, they would think that you hadn't hit bottom yet. But I had a wristwatch, I had a job, I had a car, and I had a house. So I was really doubtful, really doubtful, you know. And I don't take credit for it today. I give credit today to good sponsorship and to a good home group. And to all those people that I curse so much for volunteering me for so much. Because I wouldn't have met all. You know, I was in Minneapolis in 2000 for the International. And I was supposed to speak there on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. And we got there the Sunday before. And went out and few places and came back to the motorhome. I used the toilet, turned around to flush it, and it was bright red. After a trip to the hospital, we found out that after a colonoscopy and an endoscopy, we found out that I had a type 3 cancer about the size of a quarter that was right next to my life-saving bleeding ulcer. And so I got a chance to speak. They let me out on Friday, and they signed me out and said they let me out to speak to a few thousand of my closest AA friends. And I got a chance to stay there for a couple of months for my recovery, and I got a chance to speak at their volunteer day. I was their cleanup speaker for that. And I got a chance to tell some of the things that had happened to me. And one of the things, since I was in a wheelchair and everything, and had that shot in my neck, that I was able to tell about the last time Bill spoke there and how he came in a wheelchair. And I was able to share a lot of the different things that came from volunteers, because that's what we were celebrating, the volunteers for the convention. I'm just so grateful for so many things. I'm grateful for being here, and I'm very grateful for Felix asking me to speak, and thank you.